Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Pandora Pound on our podcast. Pandora is the Research Director at Safer Medicines Trust and author of a new book published called The Rat Trap. Pandora, please can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, thank you, Rachel. So I work at Safer Medicines Trust. So this is a UK-based patient safety charity. And we promote the use of human biology-based research technologies and approaches in drug development because we think that will make the process of developing drugs more effective and safer for
Yes.
patients.
Brilliant. And your new book, The Rat Trap, can you give us a brief synopsis of this book, please?
Yeah, I'll try.
If that's possible.
So it sets out to sort of say how we got into the practice of using animals as models for humans, starting out in France in the 19th century with physiologists. And here I argue that the practice was developed not so much out of a perceived need to advance human medicine, but as a way of raising the status of the profession of physiology in medicine through the use of the experimental method, because this made the professions appear more scientific. And then I show how and why the practice of using animals in science then quickly flourished, although there was vehement opposition, and how various industries sprang up to support this, including animal breeders, makers of cages and surgical devices, animal feed and so on. And then the second part of the book's about the limitations of using animal mod as models for humans. And in this bit, I talk about the flaws in the scientific underpinnings of this paradigm, arguing that humans and the diseases we suffer from are so varied and complex that the simplistic attempts to replicate these in animals are just bound to fail. And also that the genetic differences between animals and humans, even if they're really small, make this endeavor highly unreliable. So findings from animals might translate to humans, but more often they won't. So it's slightly random. And I also show that although we've had decades of using animals, as models for human diseases, we humans continue to suffer from diseases, even common ones like stroke and Alzheimer's and so on, for which we still lack cures. And I argue that clinical research, so research on human patients, actually has more impact on us because it's directly relevant to us. And so I look at the
Yes.
evidence showing this, as well as evidence showing that clinical researchers don't really tend to draw on animal research findings very frequently. That's just, it seems that animal researchers seem to be just writing and reporting and conducting studies for the animal research community.
Okay.
And then in the third part of the book, I look at all the options we now have for science without using animals. So all the sort of traditional approaches like clinical trials and so on, epidemiology, but also new technologies. So like AI in silico, in vitro approaches such as organoids and organs on chips. And then in the final part of the book, I discuss the obstacles to moving away from these human, to transitioning towards these human relevant technologies. And here I look at things like funding, regulation, institutional lock-in, and also resistance, increasing resistance from those who are actually using animals in research. So that's the sort of potted run through the book.
Thank you very much, Pandora. And for our listeners, I've recently read the book, and I have to say it's extremely well written and very easy to read and a very, very informative book. So definitely recommend reading this one.
Thank
And
you.
can I
That's
ask,
kind.
it's really really a great book. And can I ask what motivated you to write the book?
Well, I'm glad you said it was easy to understand because that was really part of the motivation was to write a book that would be accessible to, most people who might have some curiosity about this topic. Also, I couldn't find a sort of affordable paperback book on this topic that wasn't really about the ethics or animal welfare. So I thought there was a bit of a gap for an accessible book on the science of
Yes.
animal research. There have been books written on the limitations of science, but they 20 years ago, Ray Greek had written very well on this topic, but this was before the latest evidence was generated from systematic reviews and so on. So I really wanted to incorporate that. So really, yes, to write a book that was affordable, accessible, and that, wasn't too academic, that people would be able to pick up and understand. So that's my aim.
Yes, yep, and definitely filled that gap. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. And what would you say most shocked or surprised you during the research process for writing Rat Trap, which I envisage would have been a very lengthy process?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I wrote it, I mean, it's sort of been forming in my mind for a few years, really. So it wasn't that I was doing the research as I was writing, it was really writing down research I'd been doing for a long time. So yeah, there weren't any sudden revelations whilst writing it, but certainly over the last, decade or so, the things that have really shocked me was firstly, I think, the evidence that came out of systematic reviews that animal research was done so poorly. I mean, I just perhaps naively thought that, in such a controversial area, that scientists would be, make every effort to do their research carefully so that, it was robust, so that, each animal's life counted and so on.
Yes.
So I was really appalled to find that, so many animals were wasted through sheer bad science or because of studies not being published, and so they were repeated unnecessarily and so on. So that I found deeply shocking. The other thing I think is really the fact that much of this research just seems to be in a sort of vast echo chamber, as I just mentioned earlier, where people using animals are just writing for that community. And although the justification for doing animal research is always that, it's going to benefit humans and it's going to be useful for clinical medicine, in fact, citation analyses and so on indicate that, it's very rare that either clinical researchers or clinicians draw upon the findings from animal research. And so, you have to ask yourself what's going on there. It seems to be, I don't know, if it's not useful, why is it being conducted? And if it's not being
Exactly, yeah.
conducted to advance medicine, then, we need to rethink why society is actually, legitimizing and approving it.
Yes. And Rat Trap touches upon the difference between association and causation, which is a critical concept, I would say, in light of the common claim by proponents of animal research. We often hear that virtually every medical achievement of the last century has depended directly or indirectly on research with animals. Would you be able
Yeah.
to explain this difference to our listeners if that's something you would be happy to do?
I mean, I think it really just means that although animals are used, say, in the development of drugs, that doesn't mean to say that they were actually necessary for the development of those drugs. If you assume that the relationship between the presence of the animals and the development of drug is a causal relationship, then that's a bit of a lazy assumption, also known as a spurious association. You might equally observe that all the scientists conducting the experiments are wearing white coats, but you wouldn't then, develop a relationship between the wearing of white coats and the, say they're
Yes, yeah.
necessary for the development of drugs. So it's quite a
Yeah.
lazy association to make.
Yeah.
But, proponents of animal research have been making and relying on that assumption for, decades. I mean, and the other thing to say is that many countries have guidelines or laws that mandate the use of animals in experiments, so it's hardly surprising that they're used,
Yeah, it
Again,
has
it
to
does
be
not
in most
mean,
cases, yeah.
it doesn't mean just because they are used that they are, they're necessary or useful. And that
Yes.
would require a much closer examination of each case to see whether that was the case.
Yes, I think it's quite similar to when you hear the same claims that however many Nobel Prize scientists have used
Oh,
animals, but that is the common method. So it's not surprised that it's reflected in that. But
yeah.
there seems to be the same claim that that makes it
It's
legitimate.
strange
Yeah.
because it's so, you expect scientists making such claims to have quite a robust grasp of science, and yet it's such a lazy sort of association to make. Anyway.
Well, thank you for that explanation. And how would you say it's been a few months since the book was published? How has it been received so far?
I think it's been very well received, actually. I've been really pleased about the reviews. I think most of them have been really great. And I've been really pleased also that people have commented that it was easy to understand because that was very important to me. There has been some pushback from animal researchers, but not a great deal.
Yeah.
Just the European Animal Research Association as far as I know.
Okay.
It's been shortlisted for the Lush Prize in the public awareness category, so we're really excited about that.
I
Crossing
did
our
see that,
fingers.
and congratulations on that nomination.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, it would be great because it would give it a push, really, I think, to get it out into a wider audience, not just people who are already working in the field, but perhaps people who are, curious and want to find out a bit more. And that was really the aim, is to get it out into the general public. And so, yes, anything we can do to achieve that. I think that's the next step, really.
Yes. Fingers crossed for that award.
Thank you. Yeah, we should know in February, but yeah, we'll see. There were a lot of great entries in that category, so
Yes, it was very competitive and a lot of global entries, which is good to see, but
yeah, stiff
yeah,
competition.
more competition, yeah. So there is a push, I'm sure you're aware, a push to improve the predictive value of animal research and to conduct parallel animal research in conjunction with non-animal methods. What would be your response to such efforts?
Well, I don't think that the predictive value of animal research can be improved hugely. I mean, to some extent, of course, there can be improvements in, the experimental design of animal studies. They can be conducted better and more scientifically and more, and produce more reliable results. But and also, attending to sources of bias and making sure the animal sums are randomized and so on, improving reporting, all those things that are actually going on at the moment. The trouble is that, we've had 20 years of trying this, more than 20 years in the field of stroke, and it hasn't improved predictive ability of stroke animal models. But the other thing is that, even if you do manage to improve it, you'll never get beyond the issue of species difference, which compromises external validity. So you can play around with internal validity and prove that, the design of the studies, but actually extrapolating the findings to humans is always going to be a risky affair. It's always going to be unreliable because of the issue of species differences and the genetic differences between humans and the animals that are used. In terms of conducting animal research in parallel with, non-animal research, yeah, I think it's not a surprising development, but hopefully it'll be sort of short-lived phase as transition occurs. I mean, I did a study with Rebecca Ram, who also works for Safer Medicines Trust. And we looked at the failure of animal models in stroke research, and we looked at how the stroke researchers were actually responding to this, because it was certainly acknowledged in the field, it still is. And in this field, there seemed to be this sort of bridging strategy whereby, the people were starting to use in vitro models, but as you say, in parallel with animal studies. And we just wondered whether that was a sort of bridging strategy, a way of beginning to move away from animal models to in vitro research. So it may be a sign that transition's occurring, but on the other hand, if animal studies are used to, in inverted commas, validate human biology-based studies, as they are in some cases, then, that's a different matter. That seems to be more a way, a sort of an attempt to cling on to the animal paradigm at any cost.
Yes.
But either way, I'm optimistic, perhaps naively, that even this is a sign that human relevant approaches are presenting a challenge to scientists. So
Yes. Well, at
I'm
least I would
hopeful.
be aware of, more aware of the new methods, if nothing else, during
Yeah,
that
exactly.
process. Yeah.
And I think, the transition was never going to be, stop animal studies, start non-animal studies. There's always going to be this sort
Yeah.
of strange period, limbo and transition, whereby I think it isn't a surprising development that they're being conducted in parallel, but of course it's a bit annoying. But
Yeah.
yeah, not surprising perhaps.
Thank you. And you mentioned in your book that you observed an A-Wurm meeting, and for the benefit of our Australian listeners, that would be equivalent of an institutional animal ethics committee. So what were your key findings from this exercise? I'm really interested to hear that.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience, and I've only done it once, so I'm not sure how typical it is. Possibly quite typical, actually, based on what I've read. But what I do recall was that the only time the anticipated benefits of the proposed research were raised as an issue was when it was a question from the lay member of the committee. I don't know if you have lay members on your
We do,
committee.
yes.
Yeah. So that was the only time that, someone actually said, what was the point of the research? The vast bulk of the discussion was about animal welfare and on limiting harms to animals. At no point was there any sort of formal weighing of the harms and benefits. It just seemed that the assumption was that the research was worthwhile and it would go ahead anyway, and that the job of the committee was to limit harms as far
Yes,
as possible.
yeah.
So yeah. Also some sort of strange, I thought, power differentials at work with in terms of gender. There were I think that in this case the scientists were tended, there were a few of them, but they were most of them were male, and I think most of the people who were caring for the animals were female, and there was a bit of a
Okay.
tension between
Yeah.
the science and the welfare on one hand, and also I think the sex differences and the power at play there was quite interesting as well. So yeah, I'd love to observe a few more, but I'm not sure I'll ever be given the opportunity.
Yes, yeah, they're generally very confidential, aren't they? So, yes. Well, thank you for
Interesting.
sharing that experience. So, I just want to discuss one of the chapters, Locked In, and you discuss in this chapter cultural mindsets and the role of the general public. And you refer to the term sacrifice, which is a common euphemism for the deaths of animals used in experiments. On a symbolic level, you suggest that the daily ritualistic sacrifice of laboratory animals somehow assures us, as in the general public, something is being done to protect us from illness and death. So I'm interested to know what your insights here. What responsibility should each individual have to reject this false assurance and push for a change in research practices?
Yes, it's difficult. I mean, I think, we've all grown up with the message that animal research is vital for medical progress, and of course, the media tend to promote this view. And it's also really seductive to think that something's being done, to protect us. But I guess we can't blame individuals for, for having been misled in this way. It's society that's misled us. But, once we do know, once we do become aware, we definitely need to spread the message that, animal research doesn't protect us from illness and death. It hasn't led to cures or treatments for our common diseases. Doesn't reliably protect us from unsafe medicines. It diverts funding from approaches that, would have a greater impact on our health if only they had proper investment. Once we become aware of this, then we need to put pressure on our political representatives to transition away from animal research. We need to inform ourselves, join campaigns or organisations that are, pressing for change, such as yours and mine. Yes, generally inform ourselves, I think, but it's a difficult one. bringing about change. You know, we all struggle with that one.
Yes, yeah, it's difficult, and it
Yeah.
was yeah, very interesting that the locked in chapter, and I had never thought about that perspective of how
Yeah.
it is almost this false reassurance that people want that may be awful, but at least something's been done.
Yeah. And I think there's also a sense that we don't have to worry about it because it's being dealt with by, you know, regulators, and, you know, I'm sure it's all very, you know, well, you know, just well regulated, and I, yeah, just a feeling that someone else is taking care of it, you know, that I think people tend to rest in that sort of assumption as well.
Of course, yes. So, following on from this question, the Australian Openness Agreement on Animal Research and Teaching was launched in mid-2023. And this is based on the UK Concordant, which has been around. I'm not sure when that was launched, but for a number of years.
2014, yeah.
10 years. And you criticised the UK Concordant in the book as public relations exercise rather than as a means of achieving genuine transparency. How do you suggest greater transparency is provided to enable the general public to form educated views on the use of animals in research and teaching?
I think another difficult question. I think that greater transparency in animal research requires the public to be involved at quite a significant level. Which is not quite answering your question, but I think, you know, involving the public would, you know, would achieve much greater transparency than the sort of so selective transparency that the Concordat really presents. And I think, you know, one way of involving the public in this field is to make the applications to conduct animal research available to the general public, you know, before they're approved, so that, you know, members of the public can have input into decision making. I mean, in the UK, this was actually proposed in 2003 by the Animals Procedures Committee, which was the committee at the time that advised the Home Office on Animal Research. It's called the Animals and Science Committee now, but anyway, at the time, yes, this was actually proposed, although it was never taken up. But also, interestingly, when Understanding Animal Research were developing their Concordat in the UK, I think, you know, a few years before it was actually launched, they conducted a consultation with members of the public about it, you know, asking for their views on transparency in this field and so on. And they did, I think, focus groups and other qualitative methods to obtain these views. And it was members of the public actually suggested that they should be able to scrutinize applications, you know, to do animal research to check whether the benefits were actually likely, or were, as they put it, simply the researchers talking up their projects. And they actually stated that without evidence of this external scrutiny, they didn't feel that any other efforts to be open would be credible or convincing. And I think it was really interesting that, I mean, that didn't actually make it in, obviously, into the Concordat. But it is there to see, you know, if you go on their website, or at least it was, you know, all the documents that were leading up to the Concordat. But, you know, involving members of the public would really help to ensure, you know, true transparency. And public trust, but it would also mean that the sort of moral judgments that are inherent in animal research would reflect the values of, you know, the wider community. So I think that would be a great thing. I mean, at the moment, obviously, there's very little opportunity for members of the public to get involved. I think only as a lay member on an ethics committee. And of course, and in the UK, we have lay summaries of animal research projects published. I don't know if you do in Australia.
No, unfortunately not. No.
Yeah, but there's not a great deal we can do with them because they're anonymous. So we don't
Oh,
know
right.
where they've come from, and we don't, which means we can't then link them with any outcomes to see whether, you know,
Oh, that's a shame, yeah.
to see whether benefits have accrued, for example. So I think it'll be a long time, sadly, before there is that sort of involvement from members of the public. But I do think that that would be a fantastic way, you know, to have greater public involvement in the decisions that are made, which would not only ensure greater transparency and probably a more democratic approach to this, but it would also mean that the public would learn much more about animal research, which sort of comes back to your question really about, you know, how to educate the public.
Yes,
Really, they would, you know,
definitely.
be educating themselves and everyone else.
Yeah, it's just a case of having the information available in which to educate themselves. Yes.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
it's, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, yeah, sorry, long-winded answer.
No, thank you very much. It's good to know because we're nearly 10 years behind with that openness agreement. So what our
Well,
expectations are, we maybe have to manage those expectations.
yes, I think so.
Yes. And a bit of a personal question now, though professional as well. I'm really interested to know who has most inspired you in your career.
Yes, I don't even know if I can answer that because, you know, so many, I said that there's not really one person, but just, you know, there are so many people in this field that have, you know, given up promising careers, some of them, you know, having used animals in research as well, to try and achieve change. Lots of people who are just, you know, feel so strongly about this that they, you know, many of them working without being paid and so on. I find that very inspiring. I think my colleague Kathy Archibald, who founded Safer Medicines, and she was also a founder member of the Alliance for Human Relevant Science.
Yes, yeah.
People like her, they, you know, they work away quietly, often without any remuneration, not really seeking any publicity, but achieve such a lot. And I think, you know, in her case, changing the perception that animal research is all about animal harms to widen that out to say, well, actually, it's also about harms to humans. You know, this isn't just about animal harms, even though they're severe. It, you know, animal research harms us in so many ways, directly or indirectly. So yes, lots of people really that have inspired me and continue to, not just one person.
Of course, yeah. Thank you. And my final question, which we often ask to those who are interviewing on our podcast, do you have any suggestions for animal-free science advocacy that would help us achieve our mission on the full replacement of animals in research and teaching? Love to get your
That's
thoughts
a
on
horrible
that difficult question.
question.
Yes.
I can't answer that apart from to say keep on doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think there'll be anything I can suggest that you haven't already thought of. I think obviously collaboration is a good thing. Joining forces with like-minded organisations, strength in numbers and all that. But maybe also, you know, a dialogue with scientists who are using animals. That's can be difficult, but I think it's very can be very productive. But really, yes, just we've just all got to keep on doing our bit, and we all do something slightly different, but really we're all going in the same direction. Yes, we need to support each other, I guess.
Yes, yeah, thank you. That's really really helpful, and thank you for your dedication to this issue and your decades of work on this issue and your very impactful publications and this book and your advocacy work, and
Thank you.
very well
That's
respected
very
in this
generous.
field. So we're really pleased to have you on the podcast, and we will link to the podcast episode the details of where you can purchase the Rat Trap from. We also
Great.
recommend to our listeners to request to either your university or public library, you can put in a request that they dock the book. It's really important that there's more of this book in the public domain. I've already put in a request to my library and I've got a notification that it's here. So,
wonderful.
yes, so definitely something we can all do, and then that will mean there's other people reading this book, and it's really trying to increase the distribution so people understand this complex issue. And this is the
Thank
right
you.
book to read if you're seeking to do that. So once again, thank you very much, Pandora, and good luck with all your work, and good luck with the Lush nomination as well. Really great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It was a real pleasure to talk to you, Rachel. Thank you.